In Pioneers Wanted, Philip Clark lays out the 8 principles to address the existential threat facing many organizations. He talks to us about what he's learned interviewing pioneers in diverse fields and how it's developed his approach to consulting with leaders.
Hi, friends. Welcome back to the Evolving Leader Podcast. I'm Scott Allender, along with my co-host and the more sophisticated of our duo. And by sophisticated, I do mean older, Mr. John Gomes.
Well,
how are you feeling today, John?
I'm feeling juvenile now. No, I'm feeling great. I'm feeling really good. We've got a bank holiday in the UK here, and you've got Labor Day coming in a week. So
yeah,
we have a little bit of a surfeit of vacation time at the moment, but we probably need it to stock ourselves up for the remainder of the year coming ahead. Mm-hmm. But no, I'm feeling great. How are you feeling?
Feeling great myself. And I wanted to kick off today if I can. And of course I can, because I'm co-host of the show and I can do what I want. Thanking our listeners for being with us in all seriousness. And if you're enjoying the show, we would like you to please make sure you're subscribed on your podcast platform of choice. And stop by Apple Podcast if you can and leave us a review, which will help others find the show. And if you're brand new to our podcast, welcome and thank you for giving us a try. So let's dive into today's show with our wonderful guest. We are joined by Philip Clark, author of Pioneers Wanted. He hosts a podcast by the same name, and he's the founding partner of Hunch, a strategic innovation consultancy. Welcome, Philip.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks for joining the Evolving Leader. So let's start to get to know you a little bit. What's the arc that you've taken, particularly in wanting to help organizations wean themselves off their comfort zone of incrementalism?
Well, let's dive into it. You know, I'm at heart, I'm a strategist and an innovator. And I've, for much of the last 20 years, I've been a consultant. I've been advising large global businesses. But I've also launched some startups of my own, and I've hung out with a lot of founders. They're the kind of people who genuinely build the future. They're the people who get me excited. I think the difference in attitude and the tone of ambition has become more and more stark. And as I've worked on bigger agendas with more senior leaders, the difference has been more and more obvious. I think it's clear that we've got a massive problem in the way that we run our biggest and most powerful organizations. You know, when I was growing up, I thought that, you know, you study hard and you go and qualify at some university and you get a job in a big business, and those businesses were building the future. And it's been a real disappointment to get inside those big businesses and realize they're working really hard to maintain the status quo, incredibly hard. And actually, they're all about staying in the herd. They don't want to fall behind, but they certainly don't want to be ahead of everyone else on the whole. And these are the businesses that, you know, my kids are going to work for. These are the businesses that my pension's invested in. These are the businesses that have all of the customers and the brand and the distribution and the lobbying influence and the money. And if they're not hungry to build the future, then who the heck's going to do it? So it's been an interesting 20 years hanging out with people that inspire me. I'm working with people who have loads of potential, but not necessarily all of the intent or all of the ambition. And so my practice tries to take some lessons from one side and apply it to the others. But the book was, and the podcast is really an excuse. It was an excuse for me to hang out and record some of the conversations with some of the interesting people I've met. But also it gave me a chance to more formally do some research to see whether the stuff that felt like it was true from my own consulting experience was actually true. And that there's just this chasm, you know, there's this hole that the characteristics of pioneers don't turn up very much in the leadership teams of our largest and most important organizations, but we desperately need them to now more than ever. If we're going to build back after COVID, if we're going to solve the climate crisis, if we're going to address the challenge to Brexit, wow, we've got to do it different now.
So you started, I think, to do this, but what's your CEO chat up line?
Well, you know, I for a long time, I'd go in and I'd have a conversation with the CEO, and then they'd look at me and go, well, so what do we do about it? And I was so thrown that they agreed so readily that I didn't necessarily have my follow-up ready. I'm a terrible salesperson, I suspect. But fundamentally, this is about legacy. It's about what are you doing here? That there are very few people in big businesses who have a right and a responsibility to look over the hill. Most people in a big business are part of the machine. They're part of the engineering. And if they're disruptive or if they're rebellious or anything they do is grit in that machine. And it's only when you get to the very top of a business that you have a right to reinvent, that you have a right to look at the categories you're in and ask how they can be disrupted, that you have a right to look to the edge of the market and try and figure out what's coming and prepare to harness that or ready yourself for that disruption if it's got downside consequences. So this, to my mind, is all about, it's all about legacy. It's about what is the decisions you make now shape the careers of thousands of people, but more than that, they shape the expectations of an economy. I was fortunate enough to interview a really inspiring lady called Juliet Davenport, who set up an energy business called Good Energy. And it was the UK's sort of first real renewable energy company. And she didn't do it because she desperately wanted to run a business or that she wanted to run a renewable energy business. But it occurred to her that all the people around the table talking to the government and policymakers about energy were grey middle-aged men from incumbent businesses who said nothing could change. And it wasn't true. And she had to have a seat at the table in order to demonstrate the future could be different. Fast forward 25 years, and 46% or so of our electricity in the UK comes from renewable sources. And that's because everybody's got on board, in part because of policy interventions from the government, but in great part because large organizations were challenged by people like Juliet to do it differently. And if you're the chief executive of British Gas or a business of that scale, then it's very difficult to explain why you can't do something that this fledgling, ambitious, but fundamentally slightly amateur energy business is able to do. And that's what pioneers do for all of us. They don't necessarily change the market on their own, but they do change the game for everyone eventually.
So let's talk a little bit more about the herd. So if the bulk of the businesses you're working with and observing are busy defending the status quo, what are the costs and implications of doing that?
Well, this is the most difficult bit, actually, of my whole manifesto, is often the consequences aren't felt by the people who are making the policy decisions in those organizations today. Now, you guys know, if you're a CEO in a British company today, your tenure is half what it was 10 years ago, right? You're not going to be there very long. If you're an innovation leader, then it's 3 years tops. You know, there's a 3-year cycle in innovation. So you've got this disconnect between people's incentives and between, you know, if you're there to make long-term decisions, you're not incentivized to make long-term decisions. The mechanism which got you into the leadership position is not because you were visionary or you broke the rules or you introduced something new. It was because you played the game well in the existing business. You optimized, you did transformation programs which digitized old broken businesses, but probably didn't create anything bold and new. So we've got this strange circumstance where the people who are in control of these juggernauts aren't necessarily skilled or capable. They're very capable people, don't get me wrong. They're very capable of running those businesses. They're not necessarily attuned, or they don't necessarily have the intent to build the future. And if I think of the most meaningful interactions I've had with senior leaders, it's been the spark, it's been the intent of a leader to build beyond themselves. They recognize that they're in a fortunate position to have access to fabulous talent, great resources, and they know that things need to get better. So I do a lot of work in regulated industries, particularly in energy, but financial services is where a lot of my work comes from. And an awful lot of the roles in these regulated industries have been protected by statute for a long time. And so actually, financial services, banking had to be regulated to treat customers fairly. That gives you a sense of just how much opportunity there was for people from outside to come in and disrupt. There was nothing. Banks could get away with what they wanted. But regulators are opening these markets up, and investors are looking to place money. And as a result, you're seeing a huge amount of disruption coming from the outside and heading towards very valuable markets. Now, you've got incumbents who, and we draw this triangle, incumbents spend, in financial services, between 85 and 90% of their discretionary income, and certainly their intention, they spend it on maintaining compliance, because that's what happens in a regulated business. You've got to stay compliant. If you manage to do all of that, and many don't, then you'll spend what you've got left doing catch-up stuff, trying to do some of the stuff you've seen from competitors or the customers have been complaining about for a while, or maybe the stuff you see from some of the cool challenges. That is usually it. If you're one of those rare beasts that's reserved a few percent of your budget, you might go and do some of the obvious stuff, because in most of these regulated industries, the future casts a very long shadow. You've got between 8 and 15 years to see what's coming down the track. Sure, there are black swan events, but there's an awful lot of stuff here which you can see coming if only you go and look for it. And so if you're really lucky, you'll be in a business that can do some of that obvious new stuff. None of those businesses really set aside time, resource, or leadership ambition to build a new business, to build the future, to pioneer stuff. And that's why there is this, you know, of course, this critical advantage to being an outsider. You haven't got to feed the beast. Mm-hmm. You haven't got to play by the old rules. You can come along, and it's relatively low risk to go and do something ambitious and obvious. And that's one of the most interesting things for me, having seen the kind of fintech revolution of the last 15 years, is how unsurprising so much of it is. What is surprising is just how much money investors will put into unsurprising businesses, because these are just, you know, these are just honeypots waiting to be exploited.
Okay, so what is pioneer leadership? What does that look like?
So pioneer leadership is really about reinvention. It's about an intention to tear up the rule book, to willfully disregard the status quo. It's one of the reasons that we talk about it being quite rare in large organizations, is the things that get you to that top tier are not necessarily the things that will build for what's next. But it's about intent, it's about ambition, it's about the measure of success. You know, for sure, being a pioneer in my mind is not the same as being an entrepreneur. You know, I like the fact that large businesses are more innovative and more entrepreneurial than they were before. But an entrepreneur just wants to make a buck. And once I've done my thing, if you want to come and buy my business and make me wealthy, that's cool. I don't care whether I have systemic impact. I don't care whether the structures of the economy are different. But pioneering and pioneer leadership is about recognizing, I think it's about an expectation that if you're in a position to recognize that things could be different and you have access to the resources to ensure that they become different, well, mate, it's on you to step up and do your best to chase down that future. So pioneer leadership is about being that pathfinder on behalf of change for everyone. There's an awful lot to be said. You know, I work a lot in banking. Banks love to talk about being fast followers. Well, I've never met a bank who is really a fast anything. But, but you know, there's a really good book called something like Fast Second, something like that. And it basically makes the case that you're an idiot to go and be first. And I can't argue with the analysis in that book. If you run an incumbent business, then it is definitely safer to have a look around and move slowly. But that doesn't move society on. It doesn't do anything for any of us. It also doesn't step your business ahead and get outsized returns. Mm-hmm. And if businesses are about risk and reward, it strikes me that senior leaders in big businesses spend a lot more time thinking about their reward and about managing down risks. And pioneer leaders don't do that. For pioneer leaders, the risk is that you leave the fruit on the tree. The risk is that somebody else seizes that future. The risk is that you leave and you haven't applied your talents and resources to create the structural and systemic change that you could have done. And crucially, that your country and your economy and your society requires you to do. Because where things are now is not good enough.
So this idea of pioneer leadership, which is different, I get it's different from being an entrepreneur. I think it's a really important thing to make that distinction. Because basically what you're doing is you're creating new markets, you're solving new problems, you're leaving legacy for future generations to be able to do different things. And it's different from the forces of creative destruction as well, because I think we'll come back to that in a moment as a way of thinking about this. But the piece that strikes me here as really important to dig into is that virtually everybody that we talk to in our careers in large organizations at the senior level, the first time they're asked to do real innovation, and I don't mean the kind of incremental product development type stuff, but the market innovation, is when they get to the top. And they spent 25 years building status quo management, de-risking, as you say, down through the organization, focusing on getting to the next layer of power. And now all of a sudden they're asked to adopt a completely different way of thinking about stuff. And the tension between delivering short-term and growth or pioneering or whatever kind of different frame you want to put around it is, it's like trying to become a schizophrenic in middle age. That's quite an interesting challenge. So how do people make that leap?
I had a really interesting conversation with a guy who, I think he runs a private equity business or venture capital business. And we were having this conversation and he was talking about the fact that they invest in fast growing small businesses with a 5 and 15 year investment horizon, because they're not looking for a quick return. They're looking for a structural shift, which they can lead. Well, that was interesting. Mm. And then he said, look, if you want to really understand intergenerational decision-making and leadership, you look at family-owned businesses. And he'd talk about someone like Bertelsmann, where the fear of the people who have inherited this business is not that they're not jumping on the latest thing. It's not that they're not tapping into a couple of digits of growth. Their fear is that the business won't be there to pass on to their kids or their grandchildren. And if you're thinking about existential challenges, then you have license to make decisions which play out over quite a long time horizon. If you're in media and you look at it and you think, yeah, print media and publishing, there's no money left in that, we need to shift, then you can, assuming you can make the cash work, you can work on that for a decade to make things change. Find me a listed business or a big investor-owned business that will give you a decade's license to reinvent yourself and find out what's right. They won't, because it's not what they're there for. And so one of the things is, if you come up through a business, you're part of the machine and your skills, you become adept at managing short-term decisions for short-term gain. And that stuff's really okay as long as you're going through fairly steady waters. It's only when you get hit on the head with disruption that it gets messy, or actually when you have a situation like we have in quite a lot of regulated industries where that disruption has been kind of kept at bay by regulatory constraints. It was difficult to get into some of these markets, but now those constraints have come off. You've got a whole load of stuff that should have happened 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's now all coming, all of this obvious stuff I talked about. And you don't have enough expertise and you don't have enough money and you don't have enough capacity to fix it. I was having a conversation with a guy in a big payments business. And I spent a few years working. I had a real job once. I've mostly been a consultant, but I did have a real job. I worked in a business that's now owned by MasterCard, a payments business. And this business ran like the gold-plated infrastructure that makes sure money flows between banks. And this was not an environment in which people liked the idea of disruption or taking risks. I was really a fish out of water. I was there for a couple of years. And it was really eye-opening because I got to the end of it. And it was the first time that I suddenly thought, oh, yeah, maybe there are some places you should just strive for operational excellence. And breaking things is not welcome. That was a decade ago. And the decade since I left there, I did loads of cool stuff. Looked to me like there were loads of opportunities. And hey, guess what? Payments has been an extraordinary opportunity for an awful lot of investors and an awful lot of people. Square just bought Afterpay for $39 billion. It's a business which was, again, obvious a decade ago, right? Because it's not, there's so much pent up stuff. So there are some environments where you don't want people disrupting. I suspect that if you're undergoing heart surgery, that's not the point at which you want someone to have a brainwave. But fundamentally, if we look at a slightly more aggregate level, our expectations of what is good enough are set by the experiences we have across sectors And the expectations that leaders have of what's good enough for their business is set by the aggregate expectation of their own sector. And it's only by these challenges coming along and saying, why do we do it this way? We can do it this way. It can be fundamentally different. We can rewrite some of the basic rules. That's really helpful. But I don't think that every business can bridge from here to there. I'm a big believer that some organizations are so heavily invested in legacy operations and legacy business models, let alone legacy technology, which excites me much less than it seems to excite most people, that they're better off using their ability to create money from today's machine to either invest in tomorrow's businesses, or better still, to fund at very much at arm's length an entirely new venturing capacity with new culture and new intention to cannibalize the business they're in. All of the nearly all of the corporate innovation initiatives I've seen or been part of in the last 15 or 20 years have failed to do anything substantial in reinventing the mothership. They, you know, apps and hacks and labs, it's great innovation theater, and it makes it easy for you to connect with the startup community. Good for culture, makes you feel like you're doing something, but so little of it addresses fundamental business model reinvention that it is just lipstick on a pig. You know, the business is going in the wrong direction. Innovation teams and apps, hacks, labs aren't going to solve that problem. So I figure make hay while the sun shines, make that money, but push that money out to a new vehicle that can build the future. Fundamentally, you've either got to defend against disruption or you've got to harness it for growth. And I think the mothership needs to defend against and push the money somewhere else where it can be more effectively harnessed for growth. Sometimes the place you're at is not the right place to start your growth venture.
So in your book, you give the reader eight big themes designed to help them think about how pioneer leaders think and act. Can you give us a quick synopsis of each of those themes so that we can get a 60,000-foot view of the book, and then maybe we can dig into a couple of them that we think are particularly interesting?
Yeah, okay. So let's make this easy. Although I didn't structure the book this way, it fundamentally comes down to this acronym of pioneers. And so pioneers are purposeful. That's the first thing. They believe tenaciously in the power of an idea, and it guides them and it fortifies them. You've got to have a purpose. And there's an awful lot of big businesses don't know what they're for. Secondly, pioneers are intuitive. You know, they reframe the future. They find it easy to identify that fertile ground for category reinvention. They take the future seriously and they do something about it. The third thing, I guess, the third characteristic of a pioneer is that they outthink customers. We're at a time in business culture where customer-centered design is the way that we do innovation, or at least the way we do product work. But if we're designing based on what customers tell us they want, then we're not building the future. It's not a customer's job to build the future, but we have delegated a lot. So pioneers outthink customers. They also never settle. I think one of the things that pioneers are really very good at is harnessing structural breaks. You know, there are circumstances created by politicians or by pandemics or by, you know, fundamental shifts in culture and society, which pioneers are really good at grasping. So you can't change the game on your own. You've got to harness global forces. Fifth thing is that pioneers have a different level of expectation. This, I think, is probably the most important one. You know, an expectation that things should be better in the world, a belief that one person and a big idea can make a difference, and then holding yourself accountable to be that one person, that more than anything is the characteristic I see and I hear in the interviews that I do with pioneers. That expectation, it often comes from your upbringing, often comes from your schooling or from early role models. That's a massive determinant of that leadership intent. They also work at epic scale. I think that's also where entrepreneurs are slightly different. Entrepreneurs, you know, want to make a return, and often an outsized return. But the measure of success is structural reinvention for a pioneer. Pioneers are resilient. I think resilience actually is at the heart of building a shared conviction, mission leadership, recognizing the value of sustainability, recognize the value of humanity at the heart of what you're doing and flexibility at the heart of what you're doing. So that resilience is important if you're going to get through the hard times. And incredibly unfashionably, pioneers are acutely strategic. They're not interested in the topical or the incremental or the short-term or the fashionable. You know, harnessing disruption requires you to eschew superficiality. You've got to have a broad worldview, not be in a bubble. You have to think long-term, not short-term. You have to do things that are uncomfortable. And there's an awful lot of people who in recent business culture have talked about strategy being dead. Thinking is acutely unfashionable in some circles. But pioneers are, you know, it's not about getting lucky. Everybody's got to be lucky to achieve stuff. And we never acknowledge how lucky we often are, but being strategic, I think, is the eighth characteristic. So those are the eight, a lovely tacky acronym of pioneers, which certainly makes it easier for me to remember. But yeah, every one of those has come. You know, I researched across a few thousand companies, big businesses, and then I hung out with quite a few founders and I've recorded some of those interviews for the podcast. And it's the best time of my week hanging out with those guys because it's an absolute inspiration. You just park all of the bullshit, you get rid of all the noise, and the signal is just there. You know, purity of purpose, intuition, intention. It's all there for the taking, and that's what's really exciting. And I know, and I think we all know, that if we can harness that, or use that rather, at the head of our biggest, most powerful organizations, different things will happen. It won't look the same next year as it looked last year. But you know, I love big businesses. They're my clients. That's one reason I love them. But I love them because they have potential. But unlocking that potential is the thing that honestly frustrates me. Because I think we can do better.
Just listening to you going through those, and this really struck me when I read the book, was that, and it ties in with what you said earlier on about what the typical CEO does, which is to focus in, obviously, on the short term, but actually in pushing all the risk down the organization and almost seeing that as, you know, it's calling it accountability, but it's actually not. It's about risk and to try and de-risk things layer by layer. So if we go through, you know, most of the things that you just talked about, they are counter to creating a risk-taking, you know, environment or, you know, they are impossible in the kind of environment where risk is pushed down the organization or mitigation of risk. So you can't be intuitive because you're not allowed to trust your instincts. Because you give me the data, prove to me that what you're saying is right. So you can't do that. You can't say to the CEO of that organization, well, the customer doesn't know what they want. We're going to tell them what the future is going to be because that's, you know, going to be met with a very frosty response, which is, you know, you're not Steve Jobs. You don't have that level of creativity because that's not what we are in this organization. We don't teach people to be like that. And so on. You know, all the things that you're talking about are kind of completely stymied by that attitude to risk.
Now, look, so it's tricky, isn't it, right? Because these are valuable businesses that are doing important work in our economy, right? These aren't crooks. These aren't people who are willfully behaving badly or behaving inappropriately. They're running powerful businesses, and they're trying to optimize around what they do today.
Yeah.
And to my mind, this is mostly about outlook. This is mostly about the frame of reference. If a CEO said to me in conversation, you know, 90% of my business, my leadership attention, my resources, whatever, is going to be focused on what we do today, but we're going to carve out 10% to look over the hill, I would fall off my chair. 1% would be fine. It's not reality. Forget McKinsey three horizon thinking. There is very little ambition to look over the hill. It used to be the job of a strategy team to look out and give you a sense of where things were going to be. But that strategy teams now do pet projects and compliance and M&A, right? They don't look out. The measure of success in the business is, did we hit our quarterly, half year and year returns, not long-term creation of value. So yeah, there's a fundamental kind of cultural thing, and that's why I think creating arm's length ventures is important. But it is, there are businesses that do this. There are big businesses that do it. You know, I'm always surprised at how good MasterCard is, for example. Payments is a small world, right? Although there are more players now than there were, in sort of North Atlantic economies, MasterCard and Visa are the two big companies out there. Both clients of mine, think they're both fabulous. But MasterCard has done that, you know, has lived that reality of being number two makes you try harder. They've been faster at trying new things and rewriting the rules. And it's worked for them. They've created lots of growth pockets that they're now realizing. Visa sits in a position of being the number one, being a very successful business. They have a model which is acutely successful. And they can afford, frankly, to buy businesses when it looks like they're going to be disrupted. And that works for them. We're not very helpful in doing that. We don't really do M&A work. We might do work with them talking about the future and helping them understand emergent disruption. I'm not sure they care very much about the stuff we bring to the table. But MasterCard is a big, ugly, heavy company owned by, you know, all the same investors. But they had a leader who said, we're going to do things differently. And as a result, that whole market got shifted onwards. I think Barclays actually, you know, has a similar culture. It's a culture that reminds me of Sony, in that they don't like being part of, you know, industry-wide initiatives. They'd rather do it themselves. And Barclays has founded some fantastic businesses. Unfortunately, they lose confidence quite early. They don't stick with it very long. And that's because they're launched in the core, not launched usually at arm's length. But they still have that gene. They still have that. It's in their DNA. It's in their culture to try and build new things. But it is, the reason I can call them out is because it's quite rare. It is unusual. And you don't often get rewarded for sticking your head above the parapet, even in organizations that have a culture and an appetite to do it like this.
There are two of these that you went through that stood out to me in particular, because they feel a little bit more connected to one's mindset and perhaps something that can be constantly checked and evolved. And that was when you talked about having a different level of expectation as well as resilience. Those feel like something that can be checked in with and stand out in that way as differentiators between the others. Can you maybe illuminate for us a little bit about resilience, what that looks like, and what is an appropriate level of expectation within whatever environment somebody has, right? How do you know you have the right level of optimism but not being unrealistic?
Yeah, okay. So I think the expectation one's quite hard, actually. But let's start with resilience. One of the things that I have noted is that businesses that are built around purpose are, because they're clear on what they're for, they understand their role, they understand their measure of success beyond the vagaries of an economic cycle. You don't have to have the boss there to tell you what to do or to task you. If you know what you're all there for, then you've got embedded in the DNA of your business, you've got the pursuit. And one of the things, when we're working on initiatives with big businesses, understanding the future isn't that hard. You've got to show, you know, you've got to do the legwork. But actually the disruption intelligence, understanding the signals, weak signals on the edge of the market, it's all there for the taking if you'll do the work. But having a confidence about the bits of that you can influence, what you can harness and what you should be nervous about, understanding the consequences, understanding the domains where you can be successful. That requires you to know your own business really well. It requires you to be clear about the capabilities and the assets that give you differentiated advantage. And I'm constantly struck by how few organizations can articulate what that purpose is. Time and time again, we'll be in an organization and we'll sort of lean into purpose, and people bring out a brand document that was created by an agency for them, doing good work, but fundamentally it's a comms exercise, mm-hmm. rather than a why are we here question. And And I think resilience is, the resolute, resilient mission leadership and that conviction can only come from being really clear on your purpose and understanding your role. Recognize your role might be flexible, but understand you're part of the mission, to my mind. If you're just there and you're doing a job and you're chasing targets and you don't know why, and if you took the logo off your products and put a competitor's on, no one would notice, then it's hard to go through the difficult times, to endure those difficult times, because you understand it's laid bare that you're just a small part of somebody else's machine. Together, you're not trying to achieve anything. There's a whole thing about comfort culture, which we talk about in the book. And actually, there's an awful lot of things that big businesses seem to do to make themselves feel comfortable and pretend that they're doing stuff. And I think that all kind of covers up for this lack of intrinsic purpose. So I've sort of answered your question about resilience, I guess, by talking about purpose. But if purpose isn't at the heart of it, I think it's really difficult to have that shared conviction. So that's one side. I think the expectation is really interesting. When I talk about expectation, actually, it's very much a personal thing, and it's rooted in the belief of the power of an idea, but more than that, the fearlessness that great founders and great pioneers have. There's quite a lot of research that shows that very successful people in business actually are very fearful, and they're driven in part by the fear of failure. But certainly the people that I've interviewed and hung out with, the thing that's really struck me is this overwhelming sense that, of course, I stepped up because somebody had to, and I'm equipped to be that person. And it's that front-footedness. I was doing a podcast recently with a guy, a really bright guy, who said it didn't occur to him until his mid-20s that he'd had an alternative to working hard, going to university, joining a large company. It was kind of only in his 20s he woke up and realized that that escalator wasn't the only way to engage in the world. But every time I speak to pioneers and they talk about the way they were brought up to think about the world, they have a much more critical part in driving and affecting change. I've interviewed a lot of Kiwis, and I don't know quite why, but I'm always struck by Kiwi ingenuity and the power that Kiwi culture has to bring fresh thinking to the table. And there's a massively disproportionate number of very cool, very disruptive businesses that have had global impact. And it's come from the fact that if you live on a couple of small islands on the edge of the world, then you don't have everything at your disposal. You have to figure out a way through, and there isn't anybody coming to save you. There's nobody coming to solve your problem. You can't download the app and have Amazon deliver it same day. There's a famous book around Number 8 Wire, but there's something about Kiwi ingenuity that is embedded in the culture really early, and it says it's on me. If I want that thing to change, that's on me. And I think that's missing a lot. Now, if you can harness that in big businesses, if you can give people big goals, a lot of ambition, and enough rope to hang themselves, then that's really powerful. But it's tricky because you've got to, we all go into large organizations that have very powerful cultures. And I think there are some seismic changes around incentives, seismic changes around tone, that you have to change. Again, I think that probably goes to the place that I've come to conclude, and I've been a part of a lot of initiatives where people have done really worthy work, and I've learned an awful lot from them, and they haven't had the results that, the game-changing results those large businesses would like. And those are all really at the heart of this premise that I have, that building beyond the walls of that organization is the way to break through. If you create a new venture business, then you can create an entirely new culture. And it's everything from the way you talk and the way you dress to the way you incentivize, to the way you hire and the way you fire. It's the expectations you set of yourselves and others. You can reinvent that. And there's a certain self-selection. People in the mothership business who are misfits there might be a great fit for your new venture. And it's a way of tapping into and unlocking that talent rather than just crushing it or forcing it to leave. So I'm, you know, again, I think that, you know, that arm's length venturing model is still my favorite rather than re-engineering the incumbent business often. And perhaps that feels like giving up, but it looks more pragmatic to me because everybody is not built to be a pioneer. You know, the manifesto in this book is for senior leaders. Everybody doesn't have a right to disrupt. Everybody doesn't have a right to build the future. They might have an inclination and an appetite and an ambition, but if you're a mid-level product manager in a financial services business, you are not going to progress your career by being a disruptor. You need to either leave, or hopefully your employer will be open-minded enough to create an opportunity for you to go and leverage what you've got in a venture of some kind.
If you're enjoying The Evolving Leader, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. And don't forget to follow along on Instagram and LinkedIn. You can find us at Evolving Leader. Thank you for listening. Now, let's get back to the show.
Do you think that next generations are inherently more pioneering in their outlook because they've had to be, they've been a more of a kind of maker and entrepreneurial environment, you know, they've been able to do stuff and their expectations, you know, talk about expectation. Is that real or is it, you know, just a meme that we're talking about? Do you experience that?
I guess there's a natural truth, I guess, that a generation comes along and decries the stuff that was built by the generation before and tries to build something new. I think what's really interesting, I'm in my mid-40s, what's interesting is that if I want to understand some of the most important things that are going to shape my kids' future, it's really interesting to look at how they behave. You know, I've got a 13-year-old son who can't spell. Apart from being lazy, one of the reasons is that most of his world is digital, and the way he interacts with computers is by talking to them. And that's been his normal forever. You know, what is it, 8-10 years ago, the Daily Mail had a big splurge that Samsung TVs were listening to you talking in your house because they had nuanced technology built in. So if you wanted to turn the volume up, you could tell it to turn up the volume. And we all thought this was awful. And now we'll pay any of the big tech platforms, you know, £50 or £60 to invite these listening devices into every room of our home. And so that shift, you know, where it's always been obvious that using your fingers to tap into a glass screen is not the way that people will interact with computers. That shift is obvious. And if you spend a bit of time thinking about how the world will be, you recognize that five senses interaction with the computing or the digital environment is going to be the norm. So my son, wouldn't it be marvelous if my son goes off and, I don't know, does something fantastic in human digital interaction? It would. But I don't think that's because, I think that's just because his normal, like his starting place is different than mine. For me, talking to a computer will always have a certain amount of novelty, even though cognitively I understand it. It's still novel. For my son, it's the reason he doesn't need to spell, because computers can do that better than he can, albeit, you know, in American rather than proper English.
I guess that, you know, the reason I asked the question is because, you know, there's obviously, you know, there's a normal distribution of talent and drive and intelligence, and any generation is always kind of going to be pretty similar from previous generations. What's different is that, you know, they have the leverage of vast resources to be able to do things that they're not just incremental to what we experience. They are in a completely different, you know, they can do things globally. I mean, a child now at 5 can build a website and communicate to the whole world if they want to. And if they are a genius, by the time they're 12, they can create a multi-million pound business. They couldn't do that 30 years ago. They just didn't have the leverage.
That's interesting. So yeah, look, what are there are some conditions that are different, that's for sure. You know, there's an insane amount of capital looking for a home. I have a friend who runs a successful payments business, and every time I see him, he's trying to duck people who are chasing him to throw money at him. There is an insane amount of money chasing a return somewhere. And if you're in London or around London, that money's there for the taking. So that's radically different than when I did my first startup when I was 18. The idea of capital raising just didn't, I learned that late in life. And so I think that's one thing. Technology of course, gives you global reach. And marketplaces give you global reach. I think that's really helpful. I think there is something as well, not necessarily so much for Gen Z, but even for a millennial generation. If you came into the workforce, if you came into adulthood in an environment where all the systems and frameworks that were meant to help you accelerate your life had broken, the banks had broken, and governments didn't look like they were doing a very good job, and the dividend of peace wasn't the reality on the ground for lots of people. People were in quite a fearful place. You have this big shift, this very well documented millennial mindset of, I have to invest in myself and I have to do this for myself because big institutions won't do that for me. So I do see, and certainly in the teams that I work with, I do see an expectation difference. They don't believe that big brands and large employers have their interests at heart. And they do believe that they should be investing in themselves because fundamentally that's all they can lean on. I see that the amount of time and money that that generation spends on wellness, mental wellness in particular, is eye-opening for someone of my generation. I think there's a recognition that if, particularly in a millennial generation, that this is about equipping myself, making sure I'm healthy and equipping myself with the resources to be my best, because I can't lean on institutions to take care of me. That does, I guess, tap into the ability to raise capital much more easily, the ability to communicate and sell globally. Yeah, look, there's a guy who I talked to 6 years ago about an internship, I think it was an internship. And anyway, we didn't go forward. I didn't think he was the right guy. And I saw the other day he's raised $80 million for a new bank, and good on him. Right, it's amazing, but and I hope he's hugely successful, and he's clearly a very bright guy. But I mean, that's a much better career path for what it's worth. Go raise $80 million, be your own boss, run a new bank. Don't come and work for me. But yeah, those opportunities are there in a way that they weren't before. They're still the outliers, right? And you talk about the normal distribution; they are still the outliers. But our expectations of what we can achieve are set by the role models that we have. And I find that guy and, all of the pioneers I interview a constant source of inspiration. What's amazing to me is that we have lots of successful businesses that don't do any of this upside stuff, that aren't excited about the future, that are still stuck. I did some work recently with an insurance firm, and they do car insurance. That's about all they do. And so we were chatting with their leadership team about the fact that soon enough, we're not going to own cars. Most people don't own their cars anyway. They're financed. But soon enough, we won't even nominally own our own cars, because cars will be mobility services and we'll just get a car on demand when we need it. And I asked them what they were planning to do in that environment. We know that cars are going to have more autonomy and they'll crash less. And that has big consequences for insurers. And this is quite a big car insurer. And so I said, what are you planning for it? And they said, we decided not to think about it for now. And that was it. Like, that's okay. Like, the most senior team in a business, I don't know what they turn over, hundreds of millions of pounds. It was okay to say, yeah, we just decided we're not going to think about it for now. None of them intend to be there in 5 years or 7 years or 10 years or 15 years. But it's an outlook, isn't it? I look at it and think, everything's changing. That creates huge opportunity. Isn't that exciting? How can we accelerate it? How can we make sure we're front foot? How do we bring that about sooner so that we can harness it for growth? But more than that, the future has to be better. So let's make that so. As opposed to, that's too hard right now and nobody's asking me to do it. So we've got to shift the needle on that.
What has been maybe the most impressive or perhaps unexpected thing you've seen from pioneers during COVID? It certainly seems that some things have been accelerated, but I'm really curious about your point of view.
Yeah, there are lots of functional things, of course, that are accelerated, particularly in all of the retail and commerce and financial worlds that I'm in. But I think the thing that The thing I've seen across large businesses and small businesses is a real shift to recognize our shared humanity. And that sounds really tacky, but what that means is that if your kids run around naked in the background on your Zoom call, nobody cares anymore. You run around naked, I'm not so sure, but the kids think, you know, nobody
John freaks. Doesn't like it when I do that.
No, that's you know, just make this, you know, don't turn the cameras on. I think, but I've seen that modeled actually quite, I think large companies on the whole have done a really good job, and they've got the infrastructure and they've worked hard and they've moved beyond being faceless machines. And I think it's admirable. You know, I've only come across businesses that behaved well, to be honest. I think it's impressive. Smaller businesses, and not all pioneer businesses are small, but they do have an advantage. Those businesses where they do have that shared conviction, where they measure success by what they achieve together, and they're chasing this purpose, those guys seem much more vulnerable with each other. They seem much more open and honest. They seem much more all in, I suppose, rather than there is a part of me, the work part, that you get to have access to. In pioneer businesses, pioneers tend to attract around them people who are all in and who are wholehearted. And that vulnerability is much more honest and open. And I've seen very little poor behavior, and I've seen big businesses behave well, but pioneers in particular, they're much more like families. You know, pioneers attract people, not cult-like, not because of their charisma, but because they're chasing down something important together, and they want to get to that end thing together, right? They're going to the moon, or they're going to the pole, or whatever their equivalent of that is. They're going to get there together. And yeah, of course, you see that in the hard times. And that might be in the economic hard times. It might be at the times when you are about to fail on a fundraise. It might be when you have, you know, I was interviewing somebody in an energy company, and they had a really tricky circumstance where somebody had died because of something that had gone wrong. And, you know, that was their dark night of the soul, and they really had to lean on their values. And I think values are linked to purpose, aren't they? And pioneer business in particular, their values are the DNA of the business. So yeah, I've seen lots of that, just kind of impressive people getting beyond the bullshit of corporate life, frankly.
So as we draw to a close, I think it would be great if we could point our listeners to one of your podcasts that's a good starting point. You know, if you're going to recommend one of your shows as a good jumping off point, what would you recommend?
So I would point people, I think, to three different interviews. The first with Juliet Davenport, who set up Good Energy. I mentioned her earlier. She made an early impact in the climate crisis. And I think it's admirable what she's done. She's a great listen. She's a really inspiring lady. So Juliet, number one. Angus Searle from Hotel Chocolat. He has some great insight into how to open in Japan, but also taught me a lot about resilience and creating, embedding resilience in your leadership team. Everybody likes chocolate, and well worth a listen. And I think Fraser Thompson, who's the CEO, just stepped down actually as CEO of Chapel Down Wines. Chapel Down, you'll know, is the English sparkling wine. He was at Heineken as global brand director, and he was, you know, the epitome of plugged into big successful company. And he went to this failing little English wine company and decided he could do something amazing with it. And he did. And he's a great listen. So all of those really inspiring. And everybody likes booze and chocolate. So why not?
Is that your kind of, that's your focus now, is it?
Yeah, that's my niche. Booze and chocolate.
You're speaking my love language. I'll be sure to check those out.
Excellent. Well, Philip, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I think we've got some great insights, and thoroughly recommend that our listeners check your book out and your podcast. To get deeper into all the themes that we've talked about. So, yeah, wishing you great success, and yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Philip.
Thank you, guys.
Until next time, the world is evolving. Are you?